When she was found dead in her apartment, her roommate was the obvious suspect. But there was another suspicious man in her life, and this one kept a diary. This is the true crime story of the murder of Catherine Woods, the small-town Broadway dreamer who, yes, was also a topless dancer. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. You might notice that I have a different background while I spend a little time escaping the NYC winter in Florida, but don't worry, I'll be back in my murder cabin soon enough. Today's case was recommended to me by multiple friends who went to college at the Ohio State University. John Woods had been a band director since 1974 for, I should know how to pronounce this, Tobiddle? Don't come for me, Ohio State fans. All I know is that it stands for the best damn band in the land. People at Ohio State take their marching band very seriously, and Woods was regarded as one of the great innovators in college football halftime shows. He sadly died in 2015 at the age of 76 from Parkinson's and dementia, but this story isn't actually about him. It's about his daughter. Catherine Woods decided to leave Columbus, Ohio at the age of 17, like so many young women before her, with dreams of making it big in New York City. The lights of Broadway were calling to her, and her sad but supportive parents drove her to the Big Apple in 2002 to see that she arrived safely. Just like me, she played the baritone in the school band to make her parents happy, but unlike me, she was a graceful beauty whose heart was really in dancing. Even her very first ballet teacher knew she had a calling, and friends called her diligent, driven, and focused.
I knew her from the time she was three, when she was just a little girl with pink ballet shoes.
I met her back in high school. I remember the first time I saw her, I was so jealous of her because she was just gorgeous. And then she was just so sweet. She was very dedicated to her dance. And you could just feel how strongly she felt when she talked about it.
But in New York City, every dancer is a graceful beauty with talent to spare. Catherine wasn't getting attention from Broadway like she hoped, and it turns out New York City is very expensive and pretty lonely when you don't have a job and don't know anyone. So Catherine would come home to Ohio as often as she could. One time while she was in Columbus, she was out at a pool hall and met an aspiring rapper selling his mix in the parking lot. David Hahn was 20 years old and went by the stage name City 270. The two just clicked immediately. She was this nice middle-class girl who had been raised in the limelight of her father's fame at Ohio State, and with her, David felt like he had found his family. His childhood was haunted by drug abuse and foster homes. Catherine's aspirations made David feel more confident in pursuing his own dreams. So both of them were excited when David decided to move to New York City after a few months of dating in September 2002, to live in Catherine's Upper East Side apartment. Catherine would have the companionship she was longing for, and David would be close to this woman who made him proud. She was excited in a way that it felt like he was giving up everything to come live with her. David worked as a doorman, and Catherine got part-time jobs to pay for all of her voice, acting, and dance lessons, the headshots and the resumes, the gym memberships to keep her body strong. Things got serious quickly between the two of them. Catherine kept asking if he was going to marry her, and David said marriage was definitely on his mind, but he didn't see it happening anytime soon. Maybe that's why she eventually broke it off with him in the summer of 2005. But even after their breakup, they stayed friends and kept living together, as a lot of couples do in New York City because of the outrageous rents. He slept on the futon. The two were still living together as friends the weekend after Thanksgiving 2005 when things went bad. That Sunday, Catherine called a childhood friend and talked until around 6:25 p.m. At around 6:40, David left the apartment to go get his car to drive Catherine to work. He says he was gone for 20, maybe 30 minutes. He'd stopped to see some coworkers at the building nearby where he worked as a doorman and then pulled up on their street and called Catherine to come down. But she didn't pick up. He rang their buzzer and she still didn't answer. So he went inside their apartment, which he had left unlocked, and there he found Catherine on the bedroom floor, throat cut almost to the point of decapitation, pool of blood surrounding her. A knife had gone completely through one of her hands and through her cheek. David says he assumed it must have been an accident, but really had no idea what to think. An upstairs neighbor would later say that just a few minutes had passed between a scream and a loud thud of something hitting the floor. The neighbor, unfortunately, never called the police. The only real evidence in the apartment was one bloody handprint and the fact that someone had made several phone calls to Catherine back-to-back just before she died. Obviously, David was the first suspect, not only because Catherine had broken up with him, but because there was just so little time for someone else to have committed the crime. Catherine had hung up with her friend at around 6:25, and David had called 911 just before 7 p.m. It seemed unlikely that someone else could have shown up, murdered Catherine, and managed to make it out of the building without David seeing anything. The childhood friend who was on the phone with Catherine that night says David was a very nice guy, that she loved him and thought of him like a brother. But the police weren't so sure. David wasn't crying, didn't even seem that upset, wasn't showing any emotion at all, really. He says he's not sure why that was his reaction. But what's a quote-unquote normal reaction to finding your ex-girlfriend and close friend nearly decapitated? The New York City police questioned David for more than 35 hours, and he was fully cooperative, offering his DNA and fingerprints without asking for a lawyer. He really had to come to terms with the fact that he was going to be charged, but actually, he was eventually released. Now, if you've seen any headlines about this case, you know how disgustingly clickbaity they are. Things like the stripper murderer and the savage stripper ripper. It turns out that the band director, Dr. Woods, had been telling reporters that his daughter was working in an off-Broadway play called Privilege when she died. But when they dug a little deeper, it turns out that Privilege had ended its run months before. The Privilege where Catherine was working was a gentleman's club. And you have to hand it to Catherine for not exactly lying to her parents. The club's manager says she remembers Catherine looking like the girl next door, the sweetest and most innocent woman who had ever come in for a job. Catherine used the stage name Ava and said she was just practicing for Broadway. She openly talked about the job with friends, and while some of them discouraged her, other dancers at the bar said the money can really be too much to resist when you're making $1,000 or $2,000 on a good night. When the police realized that Catherine had this other side to her, this other life she was living, they dug a little deeper into the suspect pool. And that's where they found Paul Cortez, a 24-year-old yoga teacher and personal trainer at gyms in New York City. He and Catherine shared the same Broadway dream, so it's no wonder they hit it off. He had been raised poor in the Bronx by a single mother, but was given scholarships to fancy private schools in NYC and then Boston University. Paul had always had a passion for starring in his high school plays, so he majored in theater at BU. He was the lead singer of a rock band called Monolith, and his bandmates said he was a singer with real talent, not one of those guys who got by on his looks or charm. He wrote his own lyrics, influenced by the books he read. He was intelligent, and he was inspired by Catherine's drive. Paul gave her one of his CDs at the gym one day with his phone number, and she called him the next day. They secretly started dating, even as Catherine was still living with her ex, David. It was serious enough that Paul brought her to the Bronx Zoo to meet his mom. I'm sorry, did it just sound like I was calling his mom a zoo animal? I mean that they met his mom in the Bronx and then went to the zoo. Paul told his mom that he loved Catherine and told friends that she was the one. The one thing he didn't love was that she was a dancer. He thought it was too dangerous, especially after Catherine got sick one night from what she believed might have been a customer drugging her. She'd left her drink alone and then gone back to it later. And when she started feeling sick that night, she called Paul for help. While she was in the hospital, Paul found her father's phone number and called Dr. Woods. He said that Catherine was dancing topless at Privilege, involved in prostitution and taking drugs. But when Catherine's dad called the Privilege bar, supposedly no one by the name of Catherine was working there. When he asked about an Eva or Ava, her stage name, they hung up on him. Catherine's parents then showed up in New York to confront her, but she said that Paul was lying, that he was crazy. She broke things off with him and said she was going to get a restraining order. But the anger didn't last long. Months later, she was showing up to his concert and kissing him passionately in front of his friends. But Catherine's friends said that no matter how Paul and his friends viewed her actions, she thought of him as just a friend. And this kind of gray area and confusion is common in this case. Catherine's dance teacher said that there's no way she was into drugs, that she was so singularly focused on her Broadway dream that she would have never put it at risk. There was also this moment when Paul showed up at Catherine's apartment to surprise her in the spring of 2005, and he was greeted by David, who she was very much still dating. When David confronted Catherine about this guy who said he'd also been dating her since the previous August, Catherine simply denied it. Paul also hoped that she'd spend Thanksgiving Day with his family in 2005, but she picked David. Paul's mom says that yes, he was disappointed, but he got over it quickly with the fun and festivities that day. When Paul's mom saw the news of Catherine's murder a few days later, she immediately worried that her son was the boyfriend the reporters were referring to in their stories. But when she called Paul, he was working and claimed he had no idea Catherine was dead. He willingly gave a DNA sample to police, and Paul's friends say there's no way he's the obsessed, controlling wannabe boyfriend the subsequent news reports made him out to be. His coworker at the yoga studio called him gentle and caring and said that he didn't see any marks on Paul in the days after the murder. He would have expected to see some sort of evidence if Catherine tried to fight off her murderer. She had defensive wounds on her hands and arms. But a break in the case came quickly, not even a month after Catherine's death. A woman came out of the shadows to say that Paul had once assaulted her sexually. The police arrested and charged him and took the opportunity to gather his fingerprints, a thing they had failed to do before. They found a match to a bloody left index print seen in Catherine's apartment. Paul was charged with murder on December 23, 2005. A bandmate says that on the night of the murder, which occurred between 6:40 and 7 p.m., Paul didn't show up for their 6 p.m. rehearsal. Paul later claimed that he was at home and napping, but the bandmate said he'd also been acting strange in the days leading up to the murder. But when police found a so-called diary in Paul's apartment that supposedly had entries about slashing a throat, his bandmate said that those were lyrics. Lyrics are made up. At the time of the murder, Paul says he was in his apartment a mile and a half from Catherine's. The only problem is that calls made from his phone pinged a cell tower two blocks from Catherine's apartment, not a tower in Paul's own neighborhood. And oh yeah, he called her 13 times in 90 minutes leading up to her murder, and then never again. If you're a fan of the first season of the Serial podcast, you might remember how that was a major point against Adnan Syed. People wondered why he suddenly stopped calling Heyman Lee after her murder if he wasn't the one who murdered her. It also came out later that Paul may have previously thrown Catherine against a wall during a fight. Paul went on trial on January 29, 2007, and his defense was basically that Catherine was a loose woman, a drunk, and a drug addict. That she was mixed up with so many men that any of them could have been the murderer. You know, despite his bloody fingerprint in her blood on her wall. He says, and this is totally true, that he might have left it there during a previous visit to Catherine's apartment in her own menstrual blood. Although no signs of drug nor alcohol abuse were found in the autopsy, the defense used the fact that Catherine hadn't told her family back in Ohio about her topless dancing against her and said that, okay, Paul wasn't at home the entire time he was making calls to Catherine on the evening of her murder. He was also at a Starbucks. The prosecutor, on the other hand, called Paul an obsessive, possessive person who called Catherine up to 40 times a day, 57 times on the day they broke up, and wouldn't let anyone else have her. The defense argued back that Paul simply loved her, and that she loved him too. On February 15, 2007, Paul was convicted of second-degree murder. And the way the news reports of his trial read, you might suspect that part of the reason they found him guilty was just because of how unlikable he was. The New York Post called him morbidly self-involved, talked about his high-pitched, placid voice, and said he had told an Indian guru that Catherine had bad energy. They made fun of his love of sunsets and his reading of sacred Hindu texts. But the jury didn't seem to buy into his Zen yogi act, and it only took a day and a half for them to agree to convict. Unfortunately, all of the stories Paul probably made up about Catherine being a porn star, addicted to drugs, and prostituting herself were allowed to be voiced out loud in court for her family from Ohio to hear. At least the judge didn't allow Paul to sing any of the lyrics from his journal about slitting throats. The 26-year-old was sentenced to the maximum penalty of 25 years to life in prison. In 2014, Paul appealed on the grounds that his lawyers had been incompetent and his journal shouldn't have been allowed in court. To this day, his supporters say that bloody boot prints found on Catherine's back, yes, the killer stood on her back while she took her last breaths, were the size that both Paul and David wore. But at the original trial, a friend of Paul's said on the stand that when he saw Paul late on the night of the murder, Paul was wearing the brand of boots that left that boot print. Paul's supporters say that his friend just can't be trusted. And there was also an issue of the fact that hair was found in Catherine's hand after her murder, and yet it was never tested for DNA. Paul's appeals lawyer said that the hair looked nothing like Paul's long, wavy locks. But the Court of Appeals said that the evidence against Paul was too strong for any supposed mistakes by his defense team or the police to even matter. In 2017, Paul appealed again, this time citing a surveillance video that supposedly showed David leaving the apartment after the neighbor heard Catherine scream. The prosecutor argued, however, that the timestamp on the video was simply inaccurate, and the timeline of the crime has always been everyone's best estimate. If you've watched my other videos, you'll know that I love to consider all sides of a case and am never quick to discount conflicting evidence. I really don't disregard anything Paul's supporters say. But the thing that really gets me in this case are the alleged lyrics in Paul's journal. The New York Times reports that one of his songs was about a woman out in the Midwest where boys are dirty and girls are princesses, and she wipes clean the shaft that cuts her throat. He wrote this before the murder took place. Like, come on, Paul. But both of the guys in this case seem slightly obsessed with Catherine to me. It's not a surprise to me that Catherine and her ex David continued to share an apartment because a good apartment is hard to find in NYC. I know plenty of couples who have stayed together only because no one wanted to move out. But in addition to continuing to live with her, David would walk Catherine's dog and buy her diet meals. Maybe he was just a nice guy and a good friend, of course. But it's interesting to me that David's way of dealing with rejection was to do nice things for Catherine, like drive her to work, while Paul's method was calling her 292 times in the month of October and slashing her larynx. Today, Paul is 42 years old and still serving time in New York, while, you will never believe this, David is still out there making music as City 270. A dance scholarship at The Ohio State University was founded in 2006 in Catherine Wood's name. And I'd love to know what you think about this case. Could you ever believe that a fingerprint was left in period blood on a woman's bedroom wall and she didn't bother to clean it off? Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.